Mechanism of Action: Journey from Pathophysiology to Drug Discovery. This episode is called Mercury, the First Antibiotic and the Birth of Thiazide Diuretics. Welcome to another episode of Mechanism of Action. I'm your host, Adam J. Brown. Today we are jumping into the fourth episode on the history of hypertension and the quest to find pharmacologic medications to reduce blood pressure. In the first episode, we dug into the history of recognizing elevated blood pressure being a problem, how it took till the 1950s and 1960s to recognize that elevated blood pressure over a long period of time often have higher risk of death, higher risk of heart disease, and higher risk of strokes. In the 1960s, we got the first randomized controlled trial that I highlighted in the last episode, where three different medications were used in comparison to placebo. One was hydralazine, one was reserpine, and the third one was thiazide diuretics. Those all showed that once blood pressure was lowered, patients had an overall lower risk of dying from a heart attack or stroke. This episode is going to finish with the third drug, thiazide diuretics. I'm not just going to focus on thiazide, I'm going to tell the history of diuretics. So what is a diuretic? A diuretic is anything that helps a patient excrete fluid. Typically, the patient will notice they urinate more often on a diuretic. The two most common reasons why someone gets a diuretic is A, to lower blood pressure. If you have decreased fluid, you have decreased volume, which decreases pressure. The other very common reason this is used in a patient whose heart isn't pumping as well. When that happens, fluid starts backing up through the venous system, leading to edema in the lower extremities, as well as it can often lead up into the lungs. Patients get what's called pulmonary edema, which makes it very difficult to breathe. A diuretic can help patients start peeing out a lot of the excess fluids to help people breathe and help people ambulate and move around because their lower extremities don't get as edematous. We have different diuretics at our disposal now in modern medicine, each with unique mechanisms, mostly taking advantage of inhibition of different transporters within the renal tubules. You may be wondering how we started figuring out how to make patients pee more, besides giving them more fluid. That'd be kind of cheating with it, though. The kidneys are a complex, delicate process. How do we go about tricking the kidneys to excrete more and more urine? Not surprisingly, the first time a true diuretic was used was by complete accident. A continuous theme in mechanisms of action. Often, it starts with someone totally accidentally finding out something. But importantly, that person recognizes, hey, something here is important, let's keep pursuing it. It wasn't just one of those, oh, that's weird, shrug of the shoulders and move on. Which is a good example of what happened in 1919 in Vienna, when a young girl was admitted to the first medical university clinic in Vienna, Austria. She had congenital syphilis, so she was born with syphilis passed on by the mother. This was a relatively common situation. It's still relatively common today, but now we can knock it out with a whopping dose of penicillin, but back in the day, there's not much to do about it. The only thing that would maybe help patients, believe it or not, was mercury. So this young girl, we don't really know how old she is, but they noted this patient had an inability to walk. So I'm guessing she was at least a year older than when kids typically walk. She survived for quite a bit of time. Most people die with congenital syphilis very early on after birth. The author noted that she was emaciated to the bones with rigid and irregular pupils and absent reflexes. The patient had what's called juvenile Tabes dorsalis, where syphilis affects the spinal cord and it leads to inability to walk and know where your feet are. So it's pretty awful, something we don't see that often today, but was very, very common if you were a doctor before the 1920s. The author of the paper describing this patient was a medical student, and he actually made this first recognition of the therapy causing the patient to pee more. He goes on to defend why this case is being written up, because this case was such a common diagnosis back in the day that they wouldn't think about writing it up in a medical journal. It'd be like writing up a case of hypertension now. The author actually says, quote unquote, she was not an interesting case. The diagnosis was, quote unquote, self-evident. She was admitted by her home physician who noted she was becoming too sick to be cared for at home. The medical student actually wrote the following in the paper. The only question was, what therapy would satisfy the referring practitioner and also enable us to most quickly discharge the patient? So he's pretty much just saying, hey, this patient got dumped on us because she was too sick, they couldn't take care of at home. But there's really nothing else we can do for her. So our biggest question was, how do we get her off our wards? It's sort of shocking to see the language that was used when writing these papers up, the utter brutality and inhumaneness that this sounds like. It's hard to imagine someone writing this in a medical journal today. The medical student was tasked with giving the only known treatment for syphilis at the time, which was mercury, which is given orally or injectable. The hospital only had the injectable form, so the medical student gave this young little girl the injectable mercury. A side note is important here. The medical student notes a major change in nursing was occurring at the time. So this was really critical for the discovery to happen, because prior to World War I, the nursing was apparently not the most rigid and not the best in terms of taking care of patient charts. But after World War I, a new generation of nurses who were ambitious, inspired, and well-educated were hired. These nurses took pride in making beautiful charts and made graphs with different colors for different fluids. A blue column, for example, was made for urine output. I'll let you imagine what color was picked out for stool. The medical student recognized that he probably only noticed this change in urine output when he gave that injectable mercury because of these nice, beautiful, color-coded charts. He says that on the day of the mercury injection, the girl's urine output went from around 300 cc's to 1,200 cc's. The blue column was very large. So he opened up the chart and said, oh, wow, that's really quite a lot of urine. The next day, no injection was given and the urine output remained low. The second day, the injection was given again, and lo and behold, the urine increased to 2,000 cc's. So they said, well, is this just a fluke? Was this just a coincidence that this little girl peed, or she happened to be very sensitive to mercury? Maybe that's why she peed more. After this, the attending physician started to pay attention, and they tried the same thing on a large man, a cab driver with syphilitic disease and advanced congestive failure. Again, heart failure is something we use now for diuretics. We don't use mercury now, but we use diuretics for these patients. So this was the ideal situation. They needed to A, treat his syphilis, and B, treat his heart failure. So the medical student said, this indeed was the ideal case for the experimentum crucis, was the term he used. After the injection of mercury intramuscular, the patient passed a massive amount of almost colorless urine. The next morning, the man had eliminated 10 liters of fluid. Quote unquote, we were convinced that we had witnessed the greatest man-made diuresis in history. They wondered if the diuresis was from the anti-syphilitic effect. So was it because syphilis microbes were dying? That somehow made some change in the kidneys and that made them pee more? What was actually triggering this effect? So another young boy was admitted with heart failure, this time from rheumatic fever with severe tricuspid insufficiency without syphilis. So this kid came in with heart failure. This is important to recognize that back in the day, the hospitals were very, very different. Most of the sickest of the sick were young, something we don't see very often today, luckily. Rheumatic fever was horrendous. Rheumatic fever was an immune response developed after strep throat at a younger age, and the immune response sometimes actually attacked the valves of the heart, which led to the valves not working quite well, and it led to insufficiencies. The blood would pump, and it wouldn't get stored in the right chamber of the heart, and the blood would pump the wrong way, and it would lead to increased pressure in certain chambers that wasn't supposed to have the increased pressure, and lead to dilation of the heart, and it lead to heart failure. So this kid comes in and did not have syphilis. The medical students attending wanted to see, does the diuretic effect from the mercury have anything to do with the anti-syphilitic effect, meaning having to kill the syphilis, or would it also work in someone without syphilis? So they gave the kid mercury, and what happened? Well, the kid died the next day. The medical student wrote excitingly, before the kid died, he passed 3 liters. Again, this is shocking to see how nonchalant about death the author was. It really pushed that mercury used intramuscularly actually was a viable option to help with getting fluid off of patients. And they used it actually for decades without really knowing how it worked or why it caused diuresis. Not surprisingly, mercury has some problems. Stories of hemorrhagic colitis began to circulate with mercury. You probably heard of Mad Hatters, because people using mercury in the lining of hats back in the day led to insanity. So mercury has a lot of problems associated with it. But back in the day, when you had no other options for a young kid going into heart failure, it was often used. As far as 1948, in her textbook on the history of heart and circulation, notes mercury was a discovery that has completely revolutionized the treatment of congestive heart failure. So this is 1948, talking about literally how it completely changed how heart failure was treated, because we finally had an agent to help get fluid off of patients. Mercury agents were mostly relegated to the most severe cases of heart failure. They were not typically used for hypertension, as it was well known, even then, that mercury is not great for you and people have severe side effects. Decades later, we discovered the mechanism of how it works. Just so those nephrology nerds listening, I think primarily it blocks a sodium transporter, making people pee out sodium and water a little bit more. That's a rheumatologist describing the mechanism of a diuretic anyway. So what does that have to do with thiazide diuretics? Not a whole lot, but that mostly just pointing to the fact that diuretics are useful. And if we start designing better diuretics that are safer, they don't make you crazy or give you hemorrhagic colitis, maybe we can treat patients with heart failure better. That was what really drove interest in diuretics. It wasn't necessarily the mercury itself. It was just the mechanism of what they can do. The next chapter goes to post-World War I Germany, when a German scientist by the name of Gerard de Mock, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, discovers the first antimicrobial sulfa drugs. I know, the first antibiotic was penicillin, I hear you say. Yes, Dr. Alexander Fleming discovers the effect of penicillium on microbes in 1928 in England, but penicillin wasn't used until the 1940s when they figured out how to synthesize what penicillin was producing. I think what was striking to me was that he had such like a blockbuster medication on board and took that long to really be able to utilize it. A good kind of example of the difficulties within making it and getting enough of it was really evident in the first patient who actually ever received it, Albert Alexander, a 43-year-old police officer who during the Second War was near a bomb explosion with shrapnel, and he survived the shrapnel that went into his face and body, but he got a secondary infection. I think it was streptococcal infection. He actually had such a bad infection in the back of his eye, he had to have his eye taken out. So the patient was on death's door. He had positive blood cultures, meaning the bacteria was in his blood. And they said, hey, look, we have this penicillin. We've made some of it, maybe it'll work. He got the penicillin injection and he did well. Like his fever got better. I think his cultures went negative. His blood pressure got better. His heart rate got better. But they're only able to give him a few doses of it. Nowadays, he'd probably get many, many, many days of antibiotics, but they didn't have enough. They hadn't produced enough. So lo and behold, they ran out and the bacteria came back and eventually killed the young man. So pretty brutal. The first person who ever get penicillin actually died, but they did conclude it worked. They just didn't have enough of it. And the hospital where he got it, they actually realized they should only give it to children because in children, they weigh a whole lot less. So they can probably get away with lower doses and be able to spread out the doses more widely. Before we had amples and amples of penicillin to give to patients, we actually had sulfa drugs. You might have seen World War II movies where soldiers are sprinkling that powder onto wounds. That was sulfa powder, not penicillin. Dr. Gerard de Mock discovered sulfa drugs. His team was working on certain dyes that preferentially bound to bacteria, thinking that they could attach something to the dye that can kill the bacteria. They figured out that it was sulfa that stopped bacterial replication, hence, it was a bacterial static instead of a bacteriolytic, where the antibiotic kills the bacteria. This discovery had important implications for the Germans because sulfonamide was synthesized in 1906 and the patent actually expired. Thus, anyone could make it. So no one really made a whole lot of money on this, but it was very good for humanity. So weren't we supposed to be talking about diuretics? Well, yes. But much like mercury, which is being used to treat syphilis and accidentally found to be a potent diuretic, sulfa drugs have a similar story. But unlike mercury, sulfa drugs spawned a whole category of meds we still use today. Take that, mercury. An early observation of the use of sulfonamides to treat infections was after prolonged use, patients became acidotic, which can be seen in measuring chemicals in the blood like bicarbonate levels. This observation led some people to wonder why. Like, hey, I wonder why this is happening. Is it messing with the kidneys at all, which is important for bicarb and acid base balanced in the body, so maybe it has something to do with the kidneys. The good news is they knew to look at the kidneys. Why? Well, a lot of magical chemistry happens in kidneys that only nephrologists understand. Also, because a complication of sulfonamides or sulfa drugs was the development of urinary crystals. And not just some crystals that you see on a microscopy, but these crystals actually were big honking crystals, and they obstructed the ureters, actually causing renal failure. So the tubes that the kidneys excrete into the ureters, which go to the bladder goes to the urethra. Back in the day, just because life was brutal and painful, the treatment was sticking a big catheter up the urethra through the bladder, hopefully into your ureters, to break up the crystals. The crystal formation made people wonder what was going on in the kidneys, so nephrologists proceeded to start measuring chemicals in the urine, which they loved to do. People on sulfonamides had their urine checked often and found excess bicarbonate being excreted. Ye old acid buffer was being peed out. This made nephrologists very excited. I cannot emphasize how much nephrologists love acid-based stuff, especially in the pee. Why were the kidneys wasting bicarb like this? Well, in the 1940s, Dr. Thomas Maron and William Schwartz began to investigate it, and they had an idea of what might be going on. Why did they have a clue already? A decade before, in 1933, a certain enzyme was identified called carbonic anhydrase. Let's back up. Let's talk about the discovery of carbonic anhydrase. Well, what is carbonic anhydrase? Well, carbonic anhydrase is an enzyme that catalyzes the reversible reaction of carbon dioxide, CO2, and water, H2O, to form carbonic acid, H2CO3. Isn't that fun, everybody? When this dissociates, it breaks apart into a hydrogen ion H and a bicarbonate ion HCO3. This reaction is essential for transporting, say, CO2 from tissues to the lungs, where it is exhaled. How is carbonic anhydrase discovered, I hear no one asking? Well, let me tell you. Apparently, physiologists recognize that CO2 converts to bicarb in the blood. It happens too quickly to occur without a catalyst. Problem was, physiologists were trying to understand the reaction of blood taking up O2 from the alveoli and then giving off CO2. They made some calculations, some pretty nerdy people. They recognize the capillary in the lung is 0.3 millimeters in length, and the velocity of passing blood is 0.33 millimeters a second. Thus, red blood cells passing in the capillaries of the lungs have about 1 second to suck in oxygen and knock out CO2. The concern was just by mixing the gases, you wouldn't have enough time for this reaction to happen. This led to a prediction that some catalyst has to be at play. Some enzyme has to be there to help this happen much, much quicker. Some physiologist felt the catalyst was not needed. So this was a big, big war in the 1930s of medical physiologists who were arguing about this back and forth. Two different teams, one in Cambridge, UK, and the other one in the University of Pennsylvania, discovered the enzyme almost simultaneously, one in cows and one in red blood cells. They deemed it carbonic anhydrase. Once it was found in red blood cells, it was found in other cells, such as the lungs, liver, and the kidneys. This is the catalyst helping drive the reaction. Now back to sulfonamides. Once they recognized it to cause metabolic acidosis, they said, hey, wait a minute. This carbonic anhydrase has something to do with the bicarb and that reaction. So maybe that's what's doing it. So carbonic anhydrase became a prime suspect. And multiple studies went into this, and one published in the New England Journal of Medicine evaluates patients being treated with sulfonamides with heart failure. And they measured urine electrolytes continuously, finding an increase in both sodium and potassium excretion and an increase in urine pH. These changes can best be explained by the inhibition of carbonic anhydrase, the paper concludes. Carbonic anhydrase was quote-unquote proven to be the target through the peripheral effects seen in the urine, not by proving the biochemistry that sulfa was somehow binding to the carbonic anhydrase in the kidneys. Once carbonic anhydrase was recognized as the target, people wondered, well, maybe if we develop a drug that specifically inhibits it instead of accidentally inhibiting it with sulfa drugs, we actually might get a major improvement and be able to help with diuresis. So the quest began to find a more potent and kidney-specific carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Following World War II, after some chemical wizardry, a more potent compound was discovered, a derivative of sulfonamides. I always wonder how they do this, but reading up through the histories, people would just make thousands of compounds that were similar to the drug they were going after and just test it over and over and over in different tissues and different animal models trying to find it. And they finally found one. This compound had 1,000-fold more inhibition of carbonic anhydrase. This medication was named, drumroll, acetazolamide. No, we're not at diuretics yet. No, I know we're getting there. Okay, but this first step is acetazolamide. It's a drug you're probably aware of because it's still used today. It's considered one of the first safe diuretics, although the diuretic effect wasn't huge. Interestingly, along these times, carbonic anhydrase was all the rage and people were looking at it in different places, finding it in the stomach and recognizing it actually aids in gastric acid secretion. So acetazolamide was used for treating peptic ulcer diseases for decades. Carbonic anhydrase is also found in the choroid plexus. The choroid plexus is the part of the brain that helps produce cerebral spinal fluid. Thus, acetazolamide was actually used to treat hydrocephalus, or too much production of cerebral spinal fluid, which, as you can probably imagine, is not good. It leads to a lot of increased pressure in the brain, headaches, and potential brain damage. So carbonic anhydrase can actually decrease that. Another fun fact is we recognize that patients on acetazolamide started breathing really fast. The thought was they're becoming more acidotic, so they had to breathe off the CO2, which helps breathe off the hydrogen, to decrease the acidity. This is based off all those formulas. Anyway, you're probably not going to remember all the formulas. Let's just stick with the main points, okay? So someone said, hey, people who climb mountains need to breathe more. People in high altitudes naturally over time excrete more bicarb as they acclimate. Acetazolamide speeds this process up. So they started using acetazolamide for people climbing mountains, and it worked. You still see people going up on high-altitude trips taking acetazolamide beforehand to help them acclimate quicker. Because the diuretic effect was mild, they wanted to find more carbonic anhydrase inhibitors. well, maybe if we develop a drug that targets the carbonic anhydrase a different way, we can actually improve the diuresis part of it. They developed a compound that weakly inhibits carbonic anhydrase, but has a much more potent diuretic effect. How? They weren't sure, but noticed it caused more chloride excretion compared to ezetimibe. They called it chlorthiazide. See, we got to thiazide diuretics finally. I told you we were going to get there. After they recognized this was actually a good diuretic, they went after heart failure first. And within 2 weeks of treating patients with heart failure, they recognized it consistently lowers patients' blood pressure. Thus, multiple studies were done. Without protocols, power calculations, or predetermined number of patients, they said, hey, look, does it give this drug to these patients? And does it lower the blood pressure? And lo and behold, it worked. We know it lowers blood pressure. The problem at this point, we didn't know lowering blood pressure was good for you. It wasn't until the first controlled trial, as I mentioned in the third episode, where I dig into the VA cooperative trial, that thiazide diuretics were one of the three that were randomized. Once chlorthiazide was shown to work, they've said, how do we manipulate this more and make it even more potent and really make the diuretic the best possible? Well, they add a hydro to it, making it last longer and 15 times more potent than chlorthiazide. The nerdy way to describe it is 3,4-dihydro, meaning it has two additional hydrogen atoms, one in substitution of nitrogen on the sulfatomic ring. I'm sure you'll all remember that. I absolutely will. Thus, hydrochlorothiazide was invented. Both these medications, both chlorthiazide and hydrochlorothiazide, are used today. We know the mechanism of action much better than we used to, but it's sort of interesting that historically they were both made trying to target carbonic anhydrase inhibition, which they barely do at all now. But that was, again, discovered because sulfonamine antibiotics caused patients' blood to be acidotic, which led this whole hunt trying to figure out why, which led to one of the most important drugs in the history of medicine. So it was found by complete accident. In conclusion, there's a lot of data on thiazides, decreasing blood pressure, being used in heart failure, decreasing cardiovascular risk. They're incredible medications and have many positive impacts on innumerable lives. And not only were they one of the first safe blood pressure meds ever discovered, but they were also first-line therapy in the management of hypertension nearly 3/4 of a century later. I hope you enjoyed the story. This is the fourth episode on the history of our understanding of blood pressure and then recognizing that it is elevated, how dangerous it could be. The next episode, we're going to dig into ACE inhibitors, which is quite a story involving that whole renin-angiotensin system. And believe it or not, it all started with chasing after the mechanism of a deadly snake bite. So stay tuned. Be sure to subscribe and like and tell your friends about us. We're a new podcast trying to broaden our audience. Thanks for listening.